filled with events of great importance to the Christian. There were such things as his arrest, his trial, his crucifixion at the hands of the world. Just shortly before this, there were those fleeting moments of communion with his Father in the Garden of Gethsemane. And on that same evening, still earlier, there was the upper room, the feast of the Passover, which he ate with his disciples. Dear Lord, what memories crowd around the sacred cup. The upper room, Gethsemane, thy foes, thy lifting up. One of the most important of all of these events, and one of the most meaningful, was an incident that took place during the Passover supper. And this was the subject of our reading this morning. It was that event during which Jesus of Nazareth washed the feet of his disciples. This action on the part of the Lord was a reflection of all that he had come to do in his life. For you see, he came not to be served, he came to serve. And this action of the washing of the feet of these men was also a projection of what was about to happen on the cross. For he came to give his life as a ransom for many. The circumstances that surround this event cast a dark, brooding shadow over it. And yet they serve as the background for it. The circumstances were simply these. These men who were his disciples were arguing about who was the greatest among them. And out of that background came this action of washing their feet. Now Luke records the argument in Luke 22. John doesn't record the argument, but John records the object lesson that Jesus gave these men by washing their feet. And he gave this as his answer to their argument about their importance. The seriousness of the argument can be seen in the fact that this was the third time, at least, within as many weeks or more prior to his death, that these men had brought up this subject. Only a few weeks prior to this, they were on their way to Capernaum. And when they got there, Jesus said, "What were you talking about on the way?" And it said they wouldn't tell him because they had been talking and arguing about who was the greatest. They came on into the country of Judea and came to Jericho. And having left Jericho, were on their way up to Jerusalem, and Jesus was overwhelmed with the sense of his impending death. He was walking on out ahead of them, it says, and they were amazed. But that didn't stop them from arguing about who was the greatest. James and John, it seems, overtook him. The next verse says, after he had explained to them that he was on his way to Jerusalem to die, that he would be delivered into the hands of the chief priests and the scribes, and that they would actually abuse him and would spit upon him and would crucify him, and he would be raised again the third day. The next verse says that James and John took him aside and said, "We want you to do for us whatever we ask you." And he said, "Yes, what is it you want?" They said, "We want to sit on your left and your right hand when you come in your kingdom." So he stopped and began to teach them. He said, "You don't understand. It's not for me to give. It's for those for whom it has been prepared by my Father." But then to so much as to say, you don't understand the whole nature of the kingdom. He said the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them. And they're called their benefactors. But it's not going to be like that among you. He that would be greatest among you, let him become the youngest or the servant of all. But they didn't get the lesson. Because they went on to Jerusalem, they stayed in Bethany and went into the city to prepare for the feast. And then during the feast, here they bring it up again. Arguing, bickering, clamoring for preeminence and prominence. Insecure, clawing for position. That's the background. Can you imagine it? Can you imagine on the night of the death of the Lord that this argument was carried over from Capernaum to Jericho and was now brought up again the very night of the Passover, the very night of the death of the Lord, of his betrayal? Yes, I can imagine it. And you know why? Because you and I also sit at table with Jesus every week. And here we are, gathered around the table of the Lord, preoccupied with our own selfish interests, harboring thoughts of hatred and malice, perhaps towards some brother or sister, fearful of our own insecure positions, anxious about being so insecure, wanting the praise that's due us. And we've come here with all of those varied emotions harbored in our hearts, perhaps eaten up with lust, weakened by cravings for power, and however many other emotions you might want to list and say, here we are, just like the apostles, overwhelmed by our own self-centeredness. And yet here we sit at the table with the Lord. Yes, I can understand what these men were doing. They were involved in what so many times we ourselves are involved in when we sit at the table with the Lord. But this was the human backdrop, the human background that we see that caused the action of Jesus to shine with such brilliance. But there's another backdrop, you might call it the divine backdrop, that we see that he describes here in the first three verses or so of John's 13th chapter. The divine backdrop or the divine implications are strong and powerful and clear. And these implications are more or less the strokes of a brush on the canvas of life as we see this setting here in the upper room. These implications of the divine mind of the Lord and of the whole setting, these things are portrayed in about four or five participles. Now that's a type of a verb. They aren't in the sense of a tangible thing. They are more in the sense of qualifying verbs. They qualify action. Or in this case, they qualify and give a setting. They set the mood. And those five or four or five participles, one is implied, those are these. Jesus knowing that his hour had come, and having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. During the supper, when the devil had already put it into the heart of Judas, that's another participle, having put it into the heart of Judas. Then the fourth one again, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands. And then it's implied, it's an elliptical phrase, knowing that he had come from God and that he was going to God. All of these are participles, not a finite verb in them. They all just simply say, this happened now with this backdrop. Jesus, knowing that his hour had come, and having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Judas and the devil having already put into the heart of Judas, and Jesus knowing that God had committed all things to his hands and that he had come from God and he was on his way back to God. These are the implications that we find here in these first three verses. And oh, what these things tell us. These participles tell us that Jesus Christ knew what was about to happen to him. He wasn't the victim of circumstances. He was not the unwilling sufferer of things that he did not want to happen to him. He knew full well what was happening. He had lived under the shadow of the cross for years. Now he was right at the very base of the cross, waiting for that which God had appointed for him. And he had said before, "I lay down my life of my own will. No one takes it from me." So he sat there with these men, knowing that his hour had come to depart out of the world unto his Father. But something else it says, that he knew his own disciples, and he loved them anyway. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. He knew that Judas was there about to betray him. Verse 11 says that he knew who it was that should betray him. And then on over later in that evening, around the same table, he said, and it says his spirit was much troubled. He said, "One of you is going to betray me tonight." Yes, he knew that Judas was there, and yet he loved Judas anyway. He knew what Judas was going to do, and yet he also was willing to wash the feet of this man. Having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. He loved Simon Peter, knowing that Simon was about to deny him. He told Simon at this very table, "Simon, the cock will not crow tonight before you deny me three times." He knew that Thomas was there. He knew the doubts in Thomas's mind. He knew that Thomas was having a very difficult time coming to faith in him. He knew that James and John were there, and their clawing for power and their desire for preeminence and prominence. He could have taken those men and torn them all apart. He could have set each one of them up and just pulled him apart if he'd wanted to. But it said, having loved these men from the very beginning, or having loved them, he loved them to the end. But then there's a third thing that these participles tell us, and that is that he knew who he was. Knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand, he was not there as some private. He was there as the general of the entire operation earth. He was there fully in charge of everything that was happening. He knew that he had come forth from God. One of the participles says that he knew that he had come forth from God and that he was going back to God. His identity was not hidden from Christ. He knew who he was. He knew where he had come from. He knew where he was going. And he knew that he was completely in charge of the situation at that moment. Jesus knew all of these things. He knew his disciples. He knew that his death was impending. And he knew who he was, what he had in his hand, where he had come from, and where he was going. He knew all of this. And yet, in spite of the fact that he knew his own identity, watch how tenderly and how kindly and how beautifully he selects that method which would most likely teach these men one of the great principles of his way of living. Watch him as he searches his mind. He hears them mumbling and complaining, no doubt, and arguing over this thing. Watch him as he searches his mind then and beautifully selects this beautiful demonstration by which he gives them an object lesson and says, "This isn't the way you're to live. You're not to live arguing and being at each other's throats." Watch the contrast. These men were at each other's throat. Jesus Christ placed himself at their feet. What a difference of attitude it is. And so he says to them, in effect, you're not to live at each other's throat. You're to live at each other's feet. But anyway, you see this again, the fact that he knew what was going to happen, the fact that he knew his disciples and that they weren't really worth saving, the fact that he knew who he was, that he was God among us, all of this laid then on top of the fact that they were arguing about who was the greatest among them. All of this causes this one beautiful action of the washing of these disciples' feet to stand up and just shout and say, "Look, this is an absolutely fantastic. It's amazing." What a complete and astonishing fulfillment is this particular event of Philippians 2, verses 6 through 8, where Jesus there is said to, though he existed in the form of God, counted not the being on an equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he emptied himself, taking upon himself the form of a servant. And that's exactly what we see in this action. But these are the divine implications. These are the backdrops. And all of this has been said, and you still haven't gotten to what he did yet. The divine action is very clear. It's very concise. It's very decisive. And it's stated in just five verbs, and that's all that's said about it. Well, there's a lot said about what was going on among the disciples. There's a lot said about the whole backdrop of how much Jesus knew. But then when it gets down to simply telling what he did, five verbs he mentions here tell what he did. He arose. He put aside his garments. He girded himself. He poured the water and began to wash and wipe the feet of his disciples. And that's all that it says about it. But that's all that was needed. And so he came to Simon Peter. I don't doubt but what Simon saw him coming out of the side of his eye, or he saw him get up and wondering where he was going. And he sat and watched the preparation for the washing. And then he saw him beginning to wash those disciples' feet. And I suspect, if I know Simon Peter at all, I suspect Simon swallowed and thought, uh-oh, we've been caught out. And here he came, one after the other, till he got to Simon, and he confronts him. He startles him. He interrupts Simon's meditations on his own greatness. Simon probably was there sulking because the other disciples hadn't given him his due. No doubt he felt that he ought to be the prime one, the preeminent one, the prominent one. And here all these emotions were chewing at Simon Peter, and then here comes this man. He watches him as he progresses from one to the other, at each one of them kneeling at their feet and washing those dirty feet of these poor, miserable beggars. He overcame Simon's objection. When Simon said, "You're not going to wash my feet," Jesus so much as to say, as though he pointed his finger at him and said, "Simon, in all soberness," there's no more sober statement in all the Bible. He said, "Simon, if I don't wash you, you have no part with me." And then Simon just simply said, "Oh Lord, not just my feet, but my hands and my head as well." And in a sense, Jesus Christ broke open this boil of self-centeredness and cleaned and bathed it and dressed it for Simon, and he was well again. And you know, he comes to us the same way today. Jesus now kneels at our feet today. In this feast, each week we find Jesus Christ kneeling before us at our feet and washing us, cleansing us, interrupting us. We would really prefer not to be interrupted. We would really prefer to just kind of hold these things, these attitudes of ours and the self-centeredness. We'd like to just kind of keep it undercover and not let anybody know about it. We'd rather really not let the Lord know it. We don't really want to admit it before him. We've come here with emotions today that are not, they're not best for the Christian life. Some of you men are sulking because your wives haven't paid you the proper respect maybe during the week, or giving you the proper attention. Some of you wives are here hurt and self-centered perhaps because something went wrong in your relationship and you didn't feel like that you were held up as you should be. You brothers and sisters, you've argued. You are now holding grudges. And you would really prefer that nobody knows this but you know yourself and the person that you've argued with. They know it, but you really would rather not be disturbed. But Jesus won't let you do it. Every week he's designed this uncovering of these emotions and the breaking loose of these boils, the freeing of all this corruption and the infection of life that sin brings upon us. And as he kneels before us in this feast, he washes and cleanses us again. And then as we see ourselves finally as we really are, we know, like Simon, we're not worthy to eat the feast. And we just say, "Lord, not just my feet, my hands and my head as well." But he says, no. He looks at you. He says, "If you've been bathed, or if you have bathed, you only need to have your feet washed." I think it's a clothed implication of our coming to him in baptism in faith. He says, if you've been initially bathed, you only need to wash your feet. The daily accumulations that have accumulated on your feet during the week, he says once more again, now you need to get rid of them. You need to be cleansed. And so he comes to us and to both Simon Peter and each one of us today. He says to you, unless I wash you, you have no part in me. And that's the action. And it was very quick and very decisive. And Jesus said it is very, very necessary. The divine application is very clear, very pointed. When he had finished washing these disciples' feet, it says that he put his garments back on and then resumed his place around the table with them. And he asked them this question, do you know what I have done to you? Well, that seemed to be a very unnecessary question. They knew that he had washed their feet. But that wasn't what he was talking about. Simon had identified his action when he said, Lord, are you going to wash my feet? And Jesus had told Simon, Simon, you don't understand what I'm doing now, but you'll understand later. And then later, after he had completed this action, he began to explain what he had done. He said, do you know what I've done to you? And then he said, look, you call me Master and Lord, or Master and Teacher. And he said, you're right, because I am. He said, then if I am your Lord and Teacher, if I have washed your feet, you ought to wash one another's feet. And the application that he makes here is simply this. He says, I have given you an example. If I, your Lord and your Teacher, have been willing to stoop and wash your feet, surely you can wash the feet of each other. And Jesus at our feet draws us to each other's feet. It'll take us away from each other's throat and will reduce us in service at each other's feet. What a beautiful, beautiful expression of love and humility that he gives us here. And I think every time we gather around the table, in a sense, Jesus of Nazareth washes our feet. He humbles himself. He surrenders himself to our needs and fills a need of cleansing. And we become part of him again, and he becomes part of us all over again by this beautiful ceremony that he gave of a supper by which we can participate in his blood and in his body. And Jesus, in so coming to us, kneels before each one of you today and me and says, in effect, I've come to cleanse you. And unless you let me wash you, you have no part in me. Now I want to ask you a question. Will you then now knowingly, seeing that this is a part of Christianity, that this is a part of the mind of Christ, that you be sent out to minister to the needs of other people, people who have needs but who have no merit, other people who are like you, imperfect, who have these emotions, you know, of maybe misgivings and hatred and pride and lust and cravings and all these things that you know they ought not to have, are you willing to wash their feet? Jesus says, if I have washed your feet, surely you can wash each other's. Are you willing today, now knowing this, to come to this feast and gather around the table with the Lord and eat this knowing what it places upon you as a responsibility as a Christian? Jesus of Nazareth at our feet brings us to one another's feet. He has washed and cleansed us. And once again, the accumulation of the week, we can bring it here now. Let it be broken open. Let it be cleansed and washed. And he does this as he kneels before us now. Will you, as you eat this bread and drink this cup, will you surrender yourself not only to him and allow him to do this for you and to cleanse you? Will you then go forth cleansed to serve other people in the washing of their feet this morning? Oh, dear.